So, with your permission, I'd like to go straight into the talk, and so that we will have a little time for questions as well at the end. So I want to address a place where most of us would feel it's the most difficult place in daily life, and there we really, really need Dharma, and it's so often missing, and we're not sure where to find it. And that is the place of conflict. And conflict means in relationships, in our families, in our workplace. It means the political story. It means what's happening in the world. It means in groups. And it can mean with ourselves, internal conflicts. And conflict is there all the time. It's really funny. In Israel, everybody keeps saying shalom means peace, and there isn't any. But people say it like 100 times a day, and there isn't any. It's nothing to do with intentions. We can have the most wonderful intentions for peace, and then as soon as someone kind of rubs us up the wrong way, boom, out comes reactivity, anger, irritation. How can they say that to me? How can they do that to me? They're not listening to me. They don't understand me. They say that, and they're absolutely wrong, etc., etc. And so one of the problems is that conflict is so deep and so powerful as a force that we can feel despaired and helpless. I've been sitting on the cushion for 10 years, and I'm still angry when my partner says something like that. How can that be? The Dharma doesn't work. But we forget the Dharma does work. The meditation cushion does work. But we forget the power of conflict. It's fundamental. It's primal. It's the self reacting to the world with defense, trying to look after itself. The self is designed to look after the body, but actually what it does is just look after itself. So anybody that argues with you, it's not the body that's the problem. The body doesn't care, but it's the self that cares. So the self is defending itself all the time, and it's very primal. The self and the world are in a state of friction. That's almost the definition of me, of self, of me and the world, is friction. So we really do need to see it as big time, not easy. The Buddha, he couldn't stop conflict. He could stop some conflicts, but not all conflicts. His own monks, the Kosambi monks, started to fight each other about rules of the monks. And he couldn't stop them. And he went off to the forest for 3 months. He said, I can't deal with you guys. It's all, you're all too much. I can't stop you. So he was in the forest for 3 months by himself under a tree. And he met an elephant. And he spoke to the elephant. And he said to the elephant, why are you here on your own? You should be with your group. And the elephant said, my group are fighting each other all the time. I'm getting away. And so the Buddha and the elephant said, yes, we know. It's biological. The animals are fighting. Gorillas kill each other. I've got chickens, and they sometimes almost kill each other. I have that, you know, problem with compassion, my chickens. I don't understand it. But it's very hard. There's an old Jewish story about students who come to the rabbi and said, how do you solve the problem of conflict? And the rabbi said, well, there's an ordinary way and there's a miraculous way. And the student said, oh, okay, I understand. The ordinary way is when, you know, you sit down with someone who've got a problem with and you work it out between you. The rabbi said, no, that's the miraculous way. So the Buddha, again and again, if you read the suttas, again and again, the Buddha said there is only one place to stop conflict, and that is fundamental non-attachment. non-attachment to yourself as a self, non-attachment to your views of the way things should be or the way things are or what your views are or what your opinions or expectations are, and non-attachment to the senses, meaning what's coming in, what someone says to you is through the senses. Someone says, you're an idiot. So who knows that? The senses, and then the interpretation, and then the story. And that's all attachment. And the Buddha said also there, it needn't work. Someone says you're an idiot, you're stupid, you're no good. Only attachment will make you build a story, an interpretation, and a defense out of that and react. So it's fundamentally attachment. So the Dharma offers really huge power to deal with conflict and to deal with all other situations in life. And I have to tell you one or two stories about the peace work we've been doing over years and years in the Middle East. So we used to bring Israelis and Palestinians together in the Palestinian town of Nablus and work 48 hours with groups of 15 Israelis and 15 Palestinians. And at the beginning, of course, they all had big labeling, just like labeling of race or whatever, it's the same. Labeling, you're a Palestinian terrorist, you're a Israeli soldier, occupier, etc., etc. That's how it started off. But in 48 hours, we actually changed everything. And we did it through deep listening and looking behind the eyes and having individuals sit with each other, Israeli and Palestinian, and really understand each other and really feel each other's lives. And it worked amazingly well. So in a way, peace is really easy if you are ready for it and if you want it. It's easy. It's actually very simple. So many Palestinians say, look, all I want to do is meet an Israeli. I'm ready to and just invite Israeli for a cup of coffee and we can sort everything out. Israelis and Palestinians live on the same piece of land. They live in the same houses. They eat the same food. They've been living together 100 years. Where I live in the Galilee, we live perfectly okay, Jews and Arabs together. Arab kids come to my village and play, and Jewish, you know, kids go there. We go to the Arab villages, and the Arabs come to us all the time. There's constant exchange, and we're okay together. It's so easy. And yet, there's conflict for 100 years that's been so painful. And what's painful and what's impossible about the conflict is it's built on story. It's built on narrative. You took my land. You're a terrorist. You're a threat. It's built on story. And the stories are so dominant and so attached. But peace is easy if you want to do it. So I want to talk about some Dharma tools that really for you and everybody really help with conflict. And the first one, of course, is awareness. And awareness, and you could say mindfulness in its simplest form, is a power. It's actually not just a quality that would help us to kind of feel okay with ourselves and feel connected with ourselves. The Buddha said that if we turn the gaze from the world, acting in the world automatically, doing what we need to do and so on and so on and so on, and so on, acting in the world there, out, and we turn the gaze in, that power, he called it the lion's roar, the roar of the lion, because it's such a big difference. And awareness is really, really a major power that will help us in all conflict situations. So the first thing that we can do with it is surface the voices that we build and the stories we build around conflict. So as soon as someone challenges us, we can say, it's no good. Oh, I'm a failure. Oh, I'm here in conflict again. Oh, they're doing this. Oh, they're doing that. Oh, they're not listening to me. And we can feel helpless, or we can feel a victim, and we can feel failure. But that's just a voice. We don't need to believe those voices. So one of the first things in awareness is to see what narratives we are building when conflict happens. What stories are we building? And let's look at them. And very often we are conflict avoidance. So that's another story. We just run away. We're taught by our parents, shut up and don't make a noise and don't disturb. And so we have that kind of, inner kind of a shutdown, which is a kind of anesthesia. And anesthesia is also a voice. We can look at it with awareness, with sympathy. Yes, conflict avoidance, it's there, but it's not a big deal. I see it instead of just being it. So the awareness will also help us to see our defensiveness, to see our disturbability, how we get disturbed or irritated when we're challenged. It will show us our vulnerability and our disturbability. And that's really important. So we know, if we know it, we will slowly and steadily not just be reactive, because we'll see it as it happens. Someone says something, we'll see the tummy kind of contract a little bit, we'll feel the heat rising, we'll feel the self, the buttons being pressed, we'll feel the self there say, oh, how can they do that to me? And we'll watch the whole picture developing and disappearing. And if we do it again and again and again, we will simply find ourselves less defensive and reactive. The awareness will be instead of automatic reactivity. And it doesn't happen immediately. It takes time, but it's really, really helpful. We couldn't have done the workshops we did with Israelis and Palestinians if we ourselves, as the facilitators, were reactive. When a Palestinian would say something hard or an Israeli say something hard, if we ourselves saying, you're not allowed to say that, that's already reactive. We ourselves have to be above that. The Palestinian facilitator that we used to work with, a woman that she's like a queen. She's never had any, she never met the Dharma, but she was as if she was a Buddha. And she was 10 years in Israeli prison the police found a letter on her. And she was 10 years in Israeli prison. And when we met her, she said she spent 10 years making sure there was not one grain of hate or anger in her heart. That was her practice. So she was a kind of Nelson Mandela. I think Nelson Mandela had a similar story. And so you can see what's possible if we are really using awareness in the right way. So we also need to be bigger than success and failure in all of this. Yes, we can fail. And yes, sometimes we will not fail. The key is actually when we sit on the meditation cushion and we have an unpleasant experience, my back hurts, and we have a pleasant experience, my hands don't hurt, and we are bigger than both of them. That's the key. That's a kind of key element of meditation. That we can hold pleasant and unpleasant experiences and be bigger than both of them. And that translates into being able to hold more problematic kind of constructions in the mind, helplessness, fears, defenses, vulnerability, and so on. So awareness is a protection. And even today, the groups of Dharma people go out to the Palestinian community and protect them. Just protect them. Because they get attacked by settlers and so on. But if there's, the Dharma community just goes with the kind of courage of being steady and aware. And just go and hang around and protect the Palestinians from harm. So part of awareness is also very important is to be aware of the other, because most conflict is really about shutting ourselves down into our protective zone, and then the other is out there. And so a part of awareness is including the other in our awareness. And that means going into their shoes and a deep listening. I mean, I know that it's sometimes hard to imagine. Can we really go, if we're thinking of Trump, or I don't know, or someone we have a real problem with, can we go into their shoes? Do we want to go into their shoes? So it's problematic. It's not so easy. But it's still needed, because by being with the other, peace is basically made. What the core act, the core peacemaking action in the whole weekends we did with Israelis and Palestinians, the core was 1 hour on the second day, when we simply sat together, one Israeli and one Palestinian, and listened deeply about the story of their life pain. Tell me about your struggle in your life. And the Palestinian would say how difficult it is to deal with the violence, and how difficult it is to deal with soldiers in the street, and you know, every family has tragic stories. And the Israeli is also suffering. Less, it's true, because Israelis coming from Tel Aviv where they sit in coffee houses. But even the asymmetry is a suffering. It's not in your hands. We didn't do it. It's just the way things have turned out to be. So sharing suffering, sharing the, was actually the, where peace was made. You can no longer label the other person. If you look behind the eyes and you see the way they're struggling to live, then there's no label, black or white, black skin, white skin, Jewish, Christian, Muslim. It's all gone. There's a human being that is struggling to live. And then peace is made. You don't see a label, you see a person. So one other aspect that awareness will bring, and this is kind of down the road, is awareness of the big picture. When you're caught in conflict with somebody, or you're caught in a situation where you want to go out and change the world, you want to make change, you want to be socially active, but there's all kinds of blocks and issues and fears and resistance, and you don't want to argue with people and so on and so on and so on. One thing that will help is the big picture, the picture of interrelations. So two people caught in a conflict are actually together. They're actually interrelating. Each one comes with their causes of why they say this. They're conditioned to be like that. The parents of this one made them like that, so they say like that. And the parents of that one, you know, brought them up as a kid like that. So each one is coming with their life story and their conditions. And that picture is important. You begin to feel, okay, there are conditions, but that's the reality, a reality of interrelationship. And that's an understanding, a wisdom that goes inside. There is a famous Tibetan story about two people walking in the marketplace, and one gets hit by a stick. And he starts to shout at the stick. And his friend said, "What's the matter with you shouting at a stick? Shout at the hand that holds the stick, because the hand is hitting you." And his friend said, "Okay, okay, okay." So shouted at the hand. And then his friend said, "Well, it's a bit stupid to shout at the hand. Why not shout at the person whose hand it is? Because the person hit you." And his friend said, "Oh yes, you're right. Okay." He started to shout at the person. And his friend said, "Look, you don't know the person that hit you. He may be having a real hard time in his life. He may be subject to so many conditions that are so problematic. Maybe he hasn't eaten for 2 days. You should shout at the conditions that made him hit you with a stick." So his friend said, "Oh yeah, yeah, sure." And then said, "Wait a minute, how do you shout at conditions? Because conditions are the whole universe. So how can I shout at the whole universe?" And it's right. It gives you a bigger picture. It's basically samsara. You can blame samsara and say, oh, it's samsara's fault that we have a collapse of democracy in Israel, United States, Britain. It's all samsara. You can blame samsara, the big picture. But it does help to see interrelationship, even karma. So I won't talk about karma now. There's a chapter on it in my book. But but it just gives a sense of something bigger and wiser that will help. And one thing is really important, and especially if we're talking not just about conflict, but about going out and making change in the world and activism. In the big picture, if you hold the big picture, and again, I'm sorry to emphasize it, but I think it's really important for us to know this, what I'm going to say now. In the big picture, there is no room for measuring success and failure and measuring outcomes. So I know that it's very human to say, I'm doing this activism because I want there to be an outcome. I want there to be more social conscience, and therefore I'm going out tonight to a meeting that is dealing with whatever, abortion, social justice, peace. But you can't afford to keep measuring, because the big picture is beyond us. And therefore, the measuring can just make us go home and depressed. I can't manage it. It's all too big. It's not possible. Or I'm too little. Or I'm not ready. Or there's nothing I can do, because anyway, the whole thing is going crazy and I don't have power. All the measuring is just undoing things. So, for example, in our work with Palestinians, people say, and the Palestinians, the Palestinian Authority said to us, well, you didn't bring peace. There's still conflict. So what's the point of what you did? You didn't bring peace. You didn't get rid of one settlement. So what did you do, actually? And we said, no, you don't understand. We do something different. We change hearts and minds. And we don't measure whether the big picture, there is peace in the end or not, because it's beyond us. We offer ourselves what we can, and the world then has to look after itself. We cannot keep measuring things, because it's just a kind of one-way street to frustration and helplessness. So we said, yeah, we changed hearts and minds. And one teacher, who was a Palestinian teacher, came to us and said, I'm so, so grateful for your workshop, because for the first time, I can now talk honestly to my students and tell them that the Israelis are not all bad and that we're all caught in a situation which is bigger than us. And I can really be honest to my Palestinian students, school kids. And it's that's the fruit. But if we try and measure, well, if we changed, you know, how much we changed the world, it's a problem. So another place of Dharma which is crucial is, of course, the heart. We need to invest in compassion. We need to explore compassion. We need to push the boundary of compassion. Because very often our compassion will kind of get here and not there. We will see, be compassionate up to here and then, oh, there, but I can't go there. It's too exhausting. It's too problematic. I can give to 10 beggars outside my hotel in Varanasi in India, but there's 100. What do I do now? So I can do there so far and that's it. My kid, if my kid is crying, I run to the kid and help. But if it's the neighbor's kid that's crying, I'll say, shut up, you're disturbing my meditation. So we will find limits to our compassion, and we need to see those limits and always push them a little bit, push the boundaries of our compassion. And we did that in peace walks in the Middle East. And what we did is we did peace walks with Palestinians and Israelis. And these are not people that are necessarily, especially the Palestinians, not meditators, but they wanted to do peace activity. So we did peace walks which were quiet and slow all through Israel, with sometimes 100, 200 people walking quietly and steadily and slowly. And the message was in the walking. We're not in shouting and not in words, but in saying, look, Israelis and Palestinians can be different. Look at that. Look at us. But the practice that we did and the practice that we practiced all the time as we were walking was metta, was friendliness, enduring friendliness with every step. And the Palestinians got it as well. Even the Palestinian youth, they understood, and their heart was open to, you know, it's just an old lady next to walking by, and to the police who were assisting us or walking with us, or to the dog passing by. It was just practice of metta, and it was really powerful, practice of kindness. So we need to kind of keep going there, even though compassion is hard in such a messy world. Compassion is a problem in such a messy world that we live in. But we need to keep pushing the boundary of compassion. So, and one more, I'm just going to talk for maybe 7-8 minutes more, so we have time for questions. One more quality of the Dharma that's really crucial for us if we are going out in wanting to make change in the world, that the last words of the Buddha were, be an island to yourself, meaning stand steady, be autonomous, don't run with the herd, with what everybody says, or with all the concepts that we hear, or with all what everybody else is doing. Stay in your ground, stand in your truth. And the next few sentences after he said that, it was nearly more or less the last words before he died, so that's got to be important, and were practice care, apamada. It's like mindfulness, but it's care. Be full of care and stand your ground, stand in your truth. And that's more or less the last words. It's very important for us to be able to stand in our truth. If we stand with our truth, we can't be knocked over. And this leads to equanimity. And equanimity is a really high level of Dharma practice. It's the final one of the paramis. It's the final one of the seven factors of awakening. It's the fourth of the Brahmaviharas, which you may or you may not have heard about, all of these. Never mind. Equanimity is quite a high level of quality, inner quality. And the reason it's important, and it's high, and it's also what happens when we meditate, which is that we replace an outer protection, which is our armor, our shield, against others and against attack and against words against us and against people who don't pay attention to others, whatever. All the threats we get from outside, it turns into, we leave that, and there is an inner protection which is invisible, which is more like space. It's more inner space. As we develop our consciousness, there'll be more space. And space can't be hurt. You can't hurt space. You actually can't hurt consciousness. You can hurt what consciousness does, called me and what I need to do. But consciousness is like space, like water, like air. You can't. So equanimity is an internal place where you're not disturbed, because there's more space and there's more awareness and there's more there's less of a self. And the Dharma practice goes there. And if you can be a little bit lighter with yourselves, you will find that you will be able to go out into all sorts of difficult situations and you'll be fine. And it's that basic Dharma practice that does it. If you go on retreat, you will experience a little bit less me and mine. You'll experience more anicca, things flowing past and changing. You'll experience a little bit more inner space, and you'll find that this is invaluable when you want to go out and change the world or deal with challenging situations. It's where... So sometimes, you know, you can think, well, I can't deal with all the suffering in the world. I open the newspapers and it just makes me, I just can't deal with it. It's all too much. I understand that. But if we're more equanimous, we can experience suffering and cry. And then laugh. And we can experience more suffering and it's all right. And we're not destroyed. Because we're less disturbable. And that's equanimity. It's why the Buddha's pictures of the Buddha have long ears, because he could hear all the suffering in the world and he wasn't destroyed. And someone like the Dalai Lama, if you watch him, he cries very easily. And since I've been practicing so many years, I cry very easily. So I can easily cry. And then and then the sun comes out the next moment. And I don't find that every bit of practice I've done in my life has gone in that direction, has made me able to stand in the middle of suffering and not be knocked over by it. And because of that, I can really, I think, help others. There was a time in one of the peace workshops we did where the whole thing blew up, which is very unusual. Everyone's screaming at each other. And I didn't know what to do. So this is like 1995, I mean, seven, it's like still 20 years ago. But I took my chair and I sat right in the middle of all this screaming and shouting between Israelis and Palestinians. This is very unusual. It almost never happened. I took my chair and sat there and just sat there quietly. After 5 minutes, it all settled down. I turned to the Palestinian facilitator and said, I'm sorry, I blew it. I just couldn't hold it. They all screamed at each other. And the Palestinian said, no, you don't understand. Because you sat there in the middle, you radiated equanimity, and it all stopped in 5 minutes. Otherwise, they've been killing each other all day. I didn't even notice myself that I was doing that. I was just being equanimous, but it works. Equanimity is a power that also steadies other people. The Buddha said, you can't straighten an arrow unless you have a straight ruler to straighten it by. We have to be, you know, steady and equanimous, and then we can go out hopefully straighten twisted situations in life. It's a deep place. And just a word from that deep place, which is, if there's much less selfing, and anatta is a fundamental power that we learn in the Dharma, all our practice goes there, non-self or emptiness. What it means is that you and the world become one. There is a merging of you and the world. And when that happens, you can't be hurt, because who's going to hurt whom? You and the world are one thing. It's like right this minute, we're all together. Who can hurt whom? Where is the hurt coming from? You need a self to be hurt. So that's why it's a very deep place. And and as we practice and as we're in the Dharma, it will grow on us. We will discover this place. So a final word about going out and making change in the world. I would say two things, two tips, if you like. Instead of measuring and wanting change and frustration that we didn't get this changed or that changed, we are more relying on our Dharma qualities. So when we get up in the morning and we go out in the street, we are manifesting our qualities. Even if we don't notice them, we are manifesting our calmness, our awareness, our presence, our steadiness, our kindness. It's going to be there spontaneously. And we can trust those qualities. They are what we bring in the world in the end. Even though the mind says, I have to do a project to get this done, and it's fine. I have to go to do a project to join a group to do this. That's fine, but just don't forget that what really makes change is the qualities of the Dharma that we are expressing in life. And then, as I say, life then takes it and runs with it. The second thing I want to say is also important, and that is dana. Dana is the first of the paramis. Dana is not just generosity in terms of give a dollar here. Dana is giving our life away because we received our life. Everything we have in the exists because we are given it. There's not one thing we have which is ours. The Buddha kept it. There's quite a lot of humor in all the suttas, and the Buddha said, all you are is a bunch of oatmeal. Who do you think you are? You're just made of oatmeal. And he said it a few times. In English, porridge. So we are given everything. And actually what happens is we do give back with every word we say, with every act. As soon as we buy something, we are giving and receiving. There's nothing else that happens in our life except giving and receiving. We breathe in the air, we give out the air. We eat, we give back. That we're made of water, we're made of substances. We go under the earth in the end. Everything is all the time giving and receiving. If we know that fully, we're actually... it brings us so much joy because we feel that we give without our life is an giving. And it's just a beautiful way to live and natural and happy. And so it's a key to living with joy. So thank you very much. And I want to just finish with two words. All of this is in my book, and you can buy my book out there on the table. And also there's leaflets because I'm teaching online, and I'm teaching online courses that are a little bit deeper on the Dharma. For example, a course on self and no self of 8 talks and 8 guided meditations and 8 reading materials and exercises and so on self and no self. It's not so easy to find deep Dharma teachings online today, so there's a leaflet there, you're welcome. And I just want to finish with a small poem from my book. There's a few personal poems in the book that just inspiration. That, diamonds sparkle in the air and are quenched under water. Salt once was money in the desert, but is worthless by the sea. Value is noticed when it's missing. The pure shines out of darkness, but is invisible among the angels. Insights illuminate space, but are lost among themselves. We hold precious what is not ordinary, until we know that the ordinary is precious, and water that hides diamonds sparkles like them. So we have a little time for questions of anybody that like to raise something.
So I'm wondering about feelings of safety, like when I imagine particularly in areas where there is conflict, but even in my own life when the political world feels unsafe or my work environment feels unsafe. When those triggers are being hit, is there a most effective way to access that equanimity?
Yeah, two ways. One is to use awareness in order to expose and be friendly with the sense of vulnerability, to actually hold the vulnerability in our hands rather than going into automatic place of not safe. And for example, when we were going to the Palestinian areas, all the Israelis felt super vulnerable. No soldiers to protect them, going over the border, who knows what's going to happen. But awareness of it is fundamental. So you're again and again aware of your vulnerability and you say, yes, here it is. I know it. I hold it with kindness. And it's a construction in the mind and heart. It doesn't need to control me. And the second thing is equanimity will make you feel safer because you'll feel more spacious and steady in yourself. And that can be practiced. You can do walking meditation and just feel, I belong to this earth. I belong to the sky. I'm a big space inside me. I'm a big human being. And if we keep practicing that inner spacious awareness, it will grow. The equanimity will grow and we'll find vulnerability has less and less control on us. So they're the two places.
So it sounds like beginning by practicing in safer environments can help you cultivate it for the more stressful situations.
You can do, yes. Sometimes you need to do that. Yeah, you're right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Curious if you could give a sort of a brief biographical sketch of your own journey from, I gather, English Jewish scientist to Israeli teacher, practitioner of apparently sort of non-sectarian, let's say, Vipassana Dharma.
Well, I've only got a minute or two, so I won't go with a whole story, but I was brought up, I was English in a Jewish household in London. I left the religion and then went to study biochemistry in Oxford. And the Queen, namely the British government, was kind enough to send me to Varanasi in India for 1 year to be a lecturer in biochemistry. In India, I met Indian spirituality and Dharma, and so I practiced. And at that time, I met my wife, who was Israeli. And so we were struggling where to live. And I didn't like Israel. Israel is a hard place. I didn't like to live in a place where everyone's going around with machine guns. Just said, no, I'm a Buddhist. I don't, this place, it's out of the question. But in the beginning of the 80s, we started a community in the Western Galilee based on Mahatma Gandhi. And so I helped with 7 families to establish a peace-oriented ecological community based nothing to do with the government, nothing to do with Israel. It was like an idealistic community. I really, really enjoyed living there in that place. And there's now 1,000 people in this community. And it's still a very beautiful community in the Galilee. And it's because of that joy that I'm there until today. And also the joy of starting a beautiful Dharma community and being the senior teacher has been just so joyful. And that's kept me in Israel, plus my wife and my kids and my grandchildren, of course, and all the crowd. So I'm there. And I have to say in brackets that I no longer have resistance to Jewish teachings. I have love of the depth that exists behind all a couple of thousand years of layers of interpretations and rabbis and so on. If you cut under that and you look at the basic deep Jewish wisdom, there is there. There has to be. Just like if you go behind the monks of Burma, you'll come to the real teachings of the Buddha. So I think, you know, I'm quite interested in the Jewish wisdom, the real deep Jewish wisdom, which is there kind of underneath all the orthodoxy and the rabbis and so on, which don't interest me at all. So do we have time? I think one more question. Yeah.
Thank you so much. So I'm curious about the subject of forgiveness.
Yeah.
So when you've been facilitating these dialogues and talking about the roles of equanimity and listening, and you know, because there's giving and receiving, but there's also taking, you know, and harm. And I'll just say I really liked your parable of the stick and the hand and the arm and the person. Yeah, but then where does personal responsibility come in, and acknowledging that, and accountability? Yeah.
I think that's a really important question, and you can't. The trouble is you can't force others to do that, but sometimes you really do need yourself to go out and pay a price, and give something back, and do something in the real world in order to demonstrate that you're not part of the problem, you're part of the solution. And so forgiveness itself is very beautiful, and we do work with it. And I see forgiveness as a kind of beginning again, is a start again. It's like wiping out the past, the history, and saying, let's start fresh, let's take a new step. Sometimes you need to go out and give and pay a price. Even if you're not the one that made the problem, sometimes you will have to give dana, like repair something that was done by others. And sometimes we do that. And I think it's needed. You can't go there endlessly. Otherwise, you're running around like crazy trying to kind of fix the damage of other people that other people made. You just have to find limits. But there are times when the only thing that works is saying, here, take this. You've been deprived. Here's a gift. And it's a powerful act that needs to be done sometimes. So it's 9 o'clock. I guess we have to close the shop. Yeah?